Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the State Library of Victoria and to tonight's program of Collection Reflection. I'm sure you're all aware that tonight's program is titled Rumours of Hope and is a biography on Werner Pels. And tonight's guest is Dr. Roger Averill. And Roger was a creative fellow at the library in 2009, where he expanded on his research of Werner Pels. And Roger is a freelance researcher, editor, writer, and now published author, Roger,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah, I have been published, yeah.
And tonight we're going to have a conversation, obviously, about Roger's work and his extensive knowledge of Werner. And we're going to tackle this probably chronologically in the first sense because it makes sense. And we have a number of things to go through, and there'll be opportunities at the end to then have a look at some of the items that we've brought along this evening from the library's collections. So in that regard, Roger, I guess the first place to start is where it all began, which was his time in Germany and his early life, which thankfully there is a lot of quite rich written records of.
Well, there's not as much as I'd like being being his would-be biographer, but there most of what we know of his early life is still dependent on a memoir that he wrote in the mid-1960s called Distant Strains of Triumph. But Werner's background is in itself interesting, and I think this is one of the many of the collections that are around individuals have this kind of phenomenon where they spark off and there's all the other lives that orbit around that person. And, of course, with him, the first of those are his parents' lives. And his father had been born into a very poor family. So Werner's grandfather had died when Werner's father was 1 year old, and he had an older brother, Walter, and he was put into an orphanage. And Ludwig, Werner's father, was brought up by his mother, who was, by all accounts, a pretty miserable character. And he then served in the First World War for 4 years, and somehow, probably through dubious means, ended up making some money during that. He was only an ordinary soldier, but he came out with more money than he went in. And Werner had thought, when he was writing, as a middle-aged person writing that memoir, that it was through trading saccharin. There had been a sugar shortage during the First World War, and somehow Ludwig had got hold and on the black market had traded in some saccharin, had some money. So when he came out of the army in that incredibly turbulent time in German history, the German Revolution and the creation of you got the Spartacus fighting in the streets. You know, it's an interesting thing for me who's lived this incredibly, you know, privileged, stable life politically and economically. You know, I'm now 46, so it's been only the Whitlam dismissal is sort of the only point of reference.
So not much by comparison.
It's a pretty pale point of reference when you've got these, you know, cap putsch and you've got right-wing, left-wing fighting in the streets. But within all that, so somehow Ludwig not only survived the war, but survived all of that. And with that little bit of capital that he had, he bought a cinema in a working class part of Berlin. And of course, cinema was the medium of the time. And he, with a couple of partners, made that a great success. And they ended up owning 11 cinemas. And so by 1921, when Werner was born, Ludwig and his wife, Regina, they were very wealthy. And so Werner was born into great wealth, which is something that, knowing him, I should say that Werner was my lecturer and teacher and supervisor in the mid-80s at La Trobe University. That's where I met him. And then we became and remained close friends for the last quarter of his life, the last 20 years of his life. And he had mentioned this, you know, over the years that this had come up, and I guess I'd read that memoir at some stage too, but I hadn't fully grasped just how wealthy they were until I saw some photos, which aren't yet in this collection, but I am confident will get there in the end. They're in the possession of Werner's son, who's in England, and they were of this very done-up little boy as a two-year-old holidaying on Lake Garda in Italy, and which they did a number of times, and then they moved. They had a quite palatial house on Millerstrasse in Berlin, and then they moved to a mansion kind of on Zeutnes, at Zeutnessee, at the lake at about 50 kilometres, what is it, southwest of Berlin. And so, yeah, he was born into incredible wealth, but then survived the Ludwig's empire, sort of survived the hyperinflation, but then was hit by the Great Depression, and that wealth was eroded, and that began a sort of downward mobility, a spiralling downward mobility that began with that. Ludwig reinvented himself as an impresario and was successful at that, but by this stage the Nazis had come into power, and he was the people that he'd made a name for. One was a band leader and the other was a comic who he'd given them, you know, been crucial in getting them a national sort of profile. They no longer had to pay Ludwig because the Nuremberg laws that came in 1935 said that you didn't have to pay Jews. And so by this stage, Werner's family were living in a very poor part of Berlin in a tiny little flat that they sublet. And it's one of the mysteries as to why they, you know, this is a more general question, why more German Jews didn't get out when, you know, early on in the Nazi rule, they were encouraging people to migrate. But I think people like Ludwig, they were so in love with German culture and saw so thoroughly, you know, they were not religious Jews, though Werner did, after the Nazis came into power and kind of reminded them that they were Jewish, he did do some, you know, study and was bar mitzvahed, but because he had to go to a Jewish school and by that stage. But, yeah, they just felt that these things would pass, I think. Mm. But that wasn't to be, as we know.
And what do the letters between Werner and his parents reveal about their relationship?
Well, this was one of the finds of the collection, that there were these letters from Werner to his parents and their letters to him. And these were from a time in 1939 when, so this is, you know, after Kristallnacht, and he's finally trying to find a way out. They are trying to get him out of the country and his younger sister, Jutta, or Jutti as she was known. And he went to an agricultural training farm, and apparently there was a labour shortage. It seems hard to believe, but there was labour shortage in England of farm hands, farm labourers, and so this was one possible way out. A lot of the young people, young Jewish Germans who went to these agricultural training farms also end up in Palestine, but that'd sort of been a bit earlier, I think. Mm-hmm. So these were letters that Werner was writing back from there, reporting on his daily routine at the training farm, and then after he gets a position in Yorkshire, and he goes off there, and I'll come back to it, but it's sort of curious that the letters survived because you know, his parents were murdered in the camps, and his sister, who also got the Grosse Bresse and got to this agricultural training camp, but she didn't get a position out. And Werner was trying to get her out when he went to England, but he was only in England for a number of weeks, and then war was declared, and then it was virtually, you know, it was impossible unless you were incredibly wealthy and well-connected to get out.
Mm. And the survival of those letters too was actually in part due to a maid, is that right?
Yeah, well, back when the Pelzers had been wealthy, they had a maid called Alma Ost, and she was a young woman at that stage, and they obviously treated her very well, and she remained with them for 6 years until she got married, so during the time when they were well off. And then when they fell on hard times, and Werner's mother had, I think, heart trouble, and so she wasn't particularly well, Regina came back and helped them. She acted as a de facto maid, an unpaid maid, if you like, while they were living in these very humble flats and stuff. She, and to her own, at her own risk. I mean, she was not Jewish, and they were, and that was not the thing to do. And the story is that she was the one who somehow gathered these letters and kept them. And as soon as Yuti was in Auschwitz for 4 years and survived that, and she was on that the death march, and as soon as she got back to Berlin, well, was it Berlin? Hamburg, I think, anyway. She found a way. She contacted Ami, as they called her. But, look, one of the things that Hamish and I have been discussing for tonight was to try and get you the sense and the flavour of the collection, and really to also, which it replicates the process of that I've been going through in researching, rather than me talking about the book that I'm in the process of writing now. This will give you the things that have informed that and are informing it. So one of my great limitations, one of them, we were talking before about the technical thing, that's another, is that I don't have German. So that's been a bit of a handicap. But fortunately, I do have some good friends who are German, and one of whom has translated these letters between Werner and his parents. So this one was written on the 10th of April 1939, and it's from Ludwig. Most of them were written by Regina, Werner's mother. And this is on the second day of the Easter holiday break. And their lives, actually, they've moved to a slightly better flat than the one that Werner last lived in Oranienstrasse in Berlin. But they then had to sublet that flat. So they're down to one room, I think, and they've got a balcony. And this balcony is the recurrent thing. It is the great joy of their life. So it's just how narrowed down their lives have become, that this, the fact that they can sit out in this balcony and get some sun on their backs is a great joy to them. And they really, by this stage, it's hard for them to go out and do much. So their lives very confined. A lot of the terms of endearment and the way they refer to each other have very loving, and they were a very loving family. I think, maybe it's just me, but I think more generally we think of, when we look at those black and white folk, we think of formal, but these were people that would spend Sunday morning all in the same bed, and they'd cuddle and talk, and quite intense and physical, not in a very, I don't know, we kind of have that Victorian image cover over a long period of time in different cultures, but they weren't like that. So, my little boy, what would you think about an Easter stroll? How is it going for you? To walk with you, Mr. Youngling, is amusing and brings its own benefits. It would be even nicer with our walk ending on the balcony. A million jobs await us. And now, shall I do them all by myself? A new planter box must be made and painted, and a table, and some other boxes made smaller, etc. The balcony shall become a little paradise, a retreat. I mistype so often today, I must write slower. After subletting the room, our apartment is small again, just one little main room. But what would our apartment be without the balcony? It is a real joy. You will have some sympathy with that now. It must be terrific to work out in the open air, in nature. I am eager to hear how your work is going, how you are getting on being in a group. Because you must remember, Werner, in those last years that he was in Berlin, and his social world had been incredibly restricted. So he'd sort of grown up just with his sister and not many other kids. Just now, your lovely granny has come. It's terrible, these constant... That's being facetious. It's terrible, these constant interruptions. I just wanted to be alone with you, and then this miserable face emerges. I don't know if I've written the word correctly, but if it's wrong, you will correct me. A rare, joyless human, without interest, without the ability to read a book, without sensation. All she knows is herself and her digestion, and even this knowledge is incomplete. Hunger will force her home. Sounds heartless, but you know how vexed the situation is. How desolate to have to talk about our kin. We want to forget them. The weather is too beautiful to be gloomy, and I don't want to complain. For that, the weather is too good, the breakfast too good, the cigar too wonderful. All preconditions were here for me to savour this beautiful day. unfortunately, my luck is never complete. So it had a very... again, I think we tend to romanticise because of the... We know, from our perspective, we know what happened to these people, and we think, well, you know, they must have all been wonderful, happy families. Not the case. Werner, who was a most forgiving character, one of the most forgiving characters I've ever met, he even admitted that his grandmother was very, very miserable.
Taxing.
Yeah. So this is a letter from Werner back to his parents on June 1939. My dear Mammy and my dear Pappy, together with Jutti, his sister, I sit here at our balcony writing to you. So now they're in Grossbressen and his sister has joined him at this camp. What she has told you, I don't yet know, and to reduce the risk of repeating everything she says, there's my muck up here. I do not want to talk about work today, but to continue one or other of the conversations which you have started without receiving a response. Firstly, I have reflected on the article by Schwarzenegger, which you, dear Papachin, mentioned in one of your last letters. While tending the cattle, I managed to read it and had time to think about the problem of migration. I don't want to respond to the article itself. It's just too true, and maybe it is right that we don't think too much on the difficulties we can expect in the new world. But I want to talk about the topic Mr. Svazinski fails to mention, the sadness of migration. I don't think many people feel the same way, but for me, the day I leave Germany will be a very sad day. I leave because I have to, not because I want to. A new life starts, and that requires that an old one finishes. You are torn out of the earth where you have grown up and are planted in another, foreign, maybe incompatible soil. Friends and acquaintances are left behind, people whose language you know and whose ways of thinking you believe you know. I am still young, and as a young plant survives transplantation, so will I, when the time comes to overcome this difficult disconnection from the old. But for many adults, this disconnection may be very hard, I think. But there is still one consolation, the language and the thinking, the culture. I will hold on to them. Nobody can take this away from me. I will always be keen about the language, and Mozart and Beethoven, Goethe and Schopenhauer will follow me to the ends of the earth. I was going to read a bit more, but we probably get... There's in another letter to his mother on her birthday, where it just gives a sense of her character. So Jutti's, his sister's already written to her, wishing her a happy birthday. All I can do is repeat and affirm what she says. You do look so young in the pictures you sent us, so young you shall always be in your heart, and so strong that you can see the good in everything you experience, and that you always say, it is good this way. For these reasons, you will always be cheerful. What else can I wish for? Disease flees in front of a laughing face, and that time flies until we are together again, in America, Australia, or New Zealand, sitting together around our table and celebrating another of your birthdays. You shall have uncounted numbers of these days. This, my Mammachin, is what I wish for you, and to give you a hug and to warmly congratulate you and to kiss you and Pappy many times, your Werner. So it was interesting to me that already in his imagining, Australia and New Zealand, this is even before he got to England, were on his compass in that sense.
And so by 1940, he'd then been interned. Is that right, Roger?
At the end of 1940, he was he worked on a farm in a place called Beverley up in North Yorkshire. And we're going to play a little bit of a recording that he, of an interview he made in the last years of his life. And in that, just he talks about it, and he's, you know, very generous and laughing about what were pretty terrible circumstances. So he was with this young farmer who actually ran an experiment, he and this other guy, another German refugee, and they were, basically starved by this farmer, seeing how little he could give them and still get them to work 10-hour days. And then they gave him an ultimatum, and they went to someone else. They said, we can't do it anymore. And that night, the guy gave them an enormous meal. And, of course, if he'd done that, they would have stayed. if you'd done that all the time. And then they went to another place, and actually that was worse. The farmer there was... This guy was just... Ferner sort of thought he was just stupid, you know, this young fella, but this other one was kind of malignant and malevolent. So, but yeah, he... And because he was within, you know, there was this... the notion of friendly enemy aliens and enemy aliens in different categories, and he would have been okay, except that he was within a 50-mile radius, miles from the coast. And so there was this decision to in turn, German and Austrian Jewish refugees, well, all German citizens that were in England at the time, for fear of fifth columnists. And so Ferner was put in a camp originally in Beverly, and he was thrilled at that because they had lots of food to eat. And then they were put in a larger camp near Liverpool, and there wasn't so much food there. And then they went to Australia.
So he opted to do that?
He was one of the few that that did choose to come to Australia. There was a ship... I don't know that he knew that it was Australia, but I think most of them thought it was Canada. Is that right, Ken? Ken knows. Yeah. But he thought it was on the other side of the world anyway, and he thought, well, they won't lock us up there. You know, we'll be right there,
yeah.
And he'll be able to do something useful. Mm-hmm. So this is... He was put on this ship, the Deneira, which was an old troop carrier, and, you know, they loaded many more people than were meant to go on that ship. Mm-hmm. And it's... This is what Ferner talks about in this little excerpt.
Yes, I'll just play it now.
Just didn't have enough to eat. And so then we were asked, would you like to go to Australia?
Was this while the war was still on?
That was the beginning of the war.
Right.
That was the beginning of the war. And so I volunteered to go to Australia.
Did you know anything about Australia?
No, but I thought it was... I knew it was on the other side of the world, and I had the feeling that they wouldn't put us into another camp when we got there.
Right.
But they did, of course.
Oh.
They did, of course.
What was the trip over like for you?
Now, that was the Deneira. I don't know, you may have heard of it. It became a famous famous ship, and they made even a film of it, the Deneira Boys. So it was a kind of a troop carrier, and they took us to Australia. And they were under the impression that we were fifth colonists.
Who's this, the English or the Australians?
No, the English.
English.
They were all the English, and there was the English military, English soldiers. Oh. And as far as we could find out, they thought we were fifth colonists.
Do you think that seemed to affect the way they treated you generally?
Yes, oh, very much so. No, well, look, there was lots of people afterwards complained and thought it was terrible. But when you thought it all happened in the middle of a war, you know, where people fought battles and so on. So I always felt that was...
You had a...
I was against making much fuss about that.
You had a degree of understanding.
Yes, they did not really beat us, they did not really maltreat us, they pinched our clothes, you know, and so on. But so we came to Australia, and they treated us very well.
Can you remember how long it took you to get across to Australia?
It was a quick journey because it was a troop carrier who went straight there and, you know, brought troops back. So it was 6 weeks, I think.
Oh, that was quick.
Yeah, no, that was not. Yes. We had to go around Africa because the sea
was
canal. Yes.
Was it?
So we get a bit of a sense there of Ferner's journey.
Yeah, and I wanted to play that because that interview is in the collection, and it just gives a feel for hearing his voice that was recorded in the last year of his life. And that is interesting because Ferner's experience of both the trip on the Deneira and also, well, not so much the internment camp, but because everyone has a reasonably positive experience of that, but the trip on the Deneira, as he mentioned, it became quite controversial, and all I know is that he says that he didn't ever witness some of the atrocities, might be too strong a word, but some of the rough handling and the beatings that some other internees experienced. And that doesn't, you know, he may have just been on a different part of the ship. But apart from anything, I think age is a big factor in how people experience something like that. Werner was 18 at this stage.
Mm.
And, you know, I can remember when I was 8, you're up for an adventure if things are a bit rough. I mean, he didn't get seasick. He fell in the first night they were at sea, which was an incredibly rough night by all accounts. He fell in with the guy next to him who happened to be Felix Werder, who was this, ended up being a composer and a music critic, and they were talking philosophy. You know, so Werner's mind was elsewhere immediately. They were stepping over, you know, he talks about that in his memoir, they're stepping over these prone characters who are vomiting, and, you know, and Werner was not one to be fussed by that, yet I can imagine the indignity of that if you happen to have been a middle-aged, you know, professor from Freiburg or something, you know, and having that sort of treatment.
And I think what's interesting too, like you get a sense through that recording of the way he reflects on it and the way he handled himself and the way, as you say, his mind was elsewhere. And actually, some of the notebooks that he kept while he was interned actually aren't much about internment at all, are they, Roger?
That's right. Well, that was one, again, as a biographer, that was a disappointment. There are, along with these letters in German, there are these notebooks, and one of them has, you know, hut, what is it? I better get it right. Camp A, hut 14, written on the front, and I thought, oh, fantastic, you know, and I opened it up, and there's all these screeds of words there, and I thought, This will be wonderful, day-to-day life, how he was experiencing it, but not at all. It's all poetry. So he was writing poems. Some of them, there's a few of them that are in English. So this one is sort of at least referring a little bit to the weather and the dust. Raindrops drum down and wash the dust away that settle on this too brittle clay. But this is more the sort of thing that he was ruminating about. The time is out of joint, past and future crumble. Relentlessly, they are destroyed every second, pummeled by a million pestles in a million waters. So life is only lived in the present, lived intensely, its emotional capacity ransacked every opportunity, looted for novel sensation, every experience exploited to quench insatiable sensuousness, and no humiliation spared to satisfy insensate sexuality. And I think this is, you know, Werner's experience of internment was trying on all these different identities, really, philosophically. You know, at one stage he was hanging out with the Chasidim Orthodox Jews. So, you know, he was influenced by the communists. There was a strong communist group amongst them, and so he, and also, I mean, in his memoir, he, which is quite rare, I think, I mean, in this whole male, all male environment, and he talks about his fumbling sexuality. You know, he hadn't had much of a chance for that before he arrived there, and as it turned out, he discovered he wasn't gay, but he was very attracted to, you know, and the sorts of experiences that I guess we have read about in boarding schools and that sort of thing.
Mm.
So I had these infatuations, and I think that's the kind of candor to have written about that in the 1960s was helpful.
And so by 1942 he was released, and his first decision was to head back to England.
Yeah, he somewhere he says that he was under the illusion that he was European and that meant something, and that he wanted to go back. It's still not clear to me whether he was a pacifist at that stage. Because there's, later on, as we'll discuss, he started writing articles for The Guardian, and some of them were discursive things, others were fictional, and many of the fictional ones were only lightly veiled autobiographical things, and one of the characters in there had certainly tried to join the army. I think he hadn't wanted to join the army. I think he went, upon returning to England, he had to go to the Isle of Man briefly. I know his friend who he'd met at the internment camp in Chitura, Peter Dane, he definitely did go to the Isle of Man. His memory was that Werner didn't, but anyway, that's a little bit confused. But yeah, he wanted to go back to England, and he went back to England, and strangely, it seems, well, from this distance, and he converted to Christianity, and the details of that remain a little hazy. One thing we do know is that while he was in the internment camp in Hay and Chitura, he read the Bible as literature, really. The Bibles were, the Quakers were giving Bible at Sydney University, and SCM to, I think, Melbourne University, had provided books, and amongst those were the Bible. And Werner read it and was really taken with it. And in fact, that's... we'll jump forward where he reflects on this. So later, at perhaps the height of his media profile in England, in I think this is 68 maybe, this was a television program that he was on, a series that was called Dialogue with Doubt, and he was in conversation with John Mortimer. And the topic of, well, the topic they gave it when they published it as a book was art and imagination. And he just had a brief reflection on his childhood of being Jewish in Berlin at that time. And he says here, "I became a refugee. I came over to England, and through various experiences, passing through a stage of asceticism and a belief in Oscar Wilde and a state of communism when I believed in Marx and Lenin, I suddenly came in touch with the Bible. I came to like it enormously, and it meant very much to me. And then, through a rather traumatic experience when the news of the concentration camps came through and I knew that my parents had been among those who were in them, probably from a kind of panic, I fled into some kind of belief which had all the answers. This is very simply put. It wasn't as simple as all that, but something like that is probably behind it." And then Mortimer comes back at him and says, well, you know, can imagine being Jewish, that he might have embraced the Jewish religion. And Werner said, "Yes, though it's actually very strange that that never occurred to me. Somehow, when I came to the Bible, although the Old Testament spoke to me most powerfully, the New Testament also spoke. I think that if in those days I had met a really interesting rabbi, I would probably have become a liberal or an Orthodox Jew. I happened to meet a Lutheran pastor, and somehow it was really almost by accident that I became Christian. But then I must admit that for a number of years it meant very much to me. I believed, and that gives you a wonderful feeling, because everything suddenly does fall into place. The world becomes a much more ordered place, and it releases an enormous amount of energy in you because you haven't to ask any more questions. The answers are there. And then gradually the answers faded. The questions became more interesting, more and more interesting. And today, of course, I have reached the stage where I am much more interested in the questions than in any answers." And, yeah, I don't really know the details, but that's he ended up, this Lutheran, there was a around I actually forget the name of it, but there was a Lutheran community that he became involved in, and they were hoping to go back to Germany sort of as missionaries to the Germans to help with the reconstruction, and he was tied up with that instance.
So how long after he became a parish priest did he then begin authoring some of the books that he's known for?
Well, he pretty early on, I mean, he studied theology at Lincoln Theological College, and then he, you know, became a curate, assistant curate or whatever the term is, in Manchester, and then was given a sort of parish to look after in Lostock, which is west of Bolton. And that was 1954 when he took up that position, and then he started writing pretty soon after that, started writing these things for The Guardian. Someone encouraged him to send one off, and he did, and it got taken up, and then for the next 10 years or so, he did that pretty regularly. And he wrote a book that was published in about 1958 called Irreligious Reflections on the Christian Church. And that was his first book. That was a SCM book, which he later disowned because it was too orthodox. But that was in, 58. And then after that, he started collaborating with his wife, Lottie Hensel, became Lottie Peltz. And she also was a survivor of the Holocaust. She was an Austrian Jew, and she'd come over to England as well. And, they started working on these books. And the dynamic of that collaboration, I mean, collaborations always interest me like that. I think Werner did most of the writing, but Lottie lent some polish and flair to some things. That's according to their son.
And so they co-authored God Is No More.
Yeah, God Is No More was the book that, that if Werner was known... I mean, it's hard for us to imagine back into that early 60s time when these things mattered. And in that sense, I think the secularisation that Werner was a part of within the church outran him. So, in a sense, it became, in a very short time, and as soon as you stepped out of the church, it wasn't really of much interest to people. You know, this thing about having a more radical understanding of and a irreligious understanding of the words of Jesus, seeing them as disturbing rather than as consoling, and that didn't really have a very big audience in 10 years' time. People weren't really, but at that time, the Anglican Church was involved in what became known as the Honest to God debate, which was a book by the bishop of the diocese that Werner was in, John Robinson, and these things were hot. It was a bit of a hot topic, this liberalisation within the, and it's sort of a scandal. You know, what are these priests, and they don't believe this stuff? You know, and what
particularly
are they
with a title like God Is No More.
Well, that's rather controversial. Yeah,
it is.
And so Werner quickly became a kind of, the way the media works, he was the renegade priest that they'd pull out, and so he had that kind of profile. But God Is No More, and then they wrote another book, True Believers. And by that stage, Werner had left the parish, and he had set himself up. He had a Roundtree Fellowship at that stage, and so he was setting himself up as an independent kind of writer and commentator. And he wrote his memoir in 64.
And quite a character. I mean, one of the other pieces that you've mentioned to me is about this article called My Obituary.
Yeah.
Where I suppose it highlights just how, I guess, he didn't take himself that seriously in some respects.
Well, he does. I think I like this article because it reveals the humorous side to him. And there was always a very playful side to him underneath the seriousness. I mean, Werner did think we should take life seriously. One of the things that he did in Lostock, which, sort of fires my imagination. If you think in 1954, Lostock, this is Lancashire, an old mill town, pretty run down, the sort of industry's died. These phlegmatic characters that, if the stereotypes hold, and Werner and his wife, these exotic characters turning up there, and Werner, in his first sermon, reputedly said, I don't want anyone to come to church out of obligation, out of habit. You only come if you want to come. And then the next week there was about three people in the congregation. But they snapped into action and they thought, we'll write plays for them and they got people involved in these performances. And also Werner was very early in his concern for nuclear armaments. And this is reflected in this article in a backhand kind of way. And he started this Lostock group, and it had other groups that sprang up in its name, which was sort of a precursor to the P&D movement. But yes, this was another find for me. I thought, fantastic, this is the I think it's called the Bolton Journal and Guardian or something, the local newspaper, which Werner had obviously contributed to quite a lot in trying to push his various barrows, mainly the anti-nuclear thing. and they had run this series called My Obituary, where they got prominent people within the community to write their own obituary. Sort of morbid idea, really. It starts with in 2021, and it's the centenary of his birth. And I won't read that, but that's the framing thing for what he does, where he's actually become posthumously famous. And so he's having a joke at his own sort of hubris and ambition in that. But then it says, you know, you might be interested to read the obituary that appeared in the Bolton Evening News on October 3rd, 1990, the day after his death by leukemia. So this is the supposed obituary. We announce with regret the death at Bolton and District General Hospital of the Reverend Werner Peltz, who has been curate in charge at St Thomas and St John's Lostock for 36 years. Although he lived for the greater part of his life on the fringe of Bolton and never very fully entered into the civic activities of our town, he has been a well-known figure nevertheless. His photograph, which we are sorry to say has remained the same since 1954, the year of his arrival at Lostock, has appeared regularly in the Bolton Evening News in connection with appeals for refugees, protests against the hydrogen bomb, protests against certain aspects of British foreign policy, and against television in general. The Reverend W. Peltz was born in Germany 69 years ago. He had to leave his country on account of the activities of a certain Adolf Hitler, who had been dictator of Germany before and during the last but one war. He carried certain aspects of his Teutonic upbringing through the whole of his life, and he took things very seriously. And if some of the plays he wrote were actually very funny, it was probably due to the influence of his wife, who was born in Austria, where people are much more light-hearted. Yes, he did dabble in literature as well as in theology. He wrote numerous books and plays, none of which were very successful. The continental strain in them was too marked. His parishioners could escape from his impetuous efforts to make them think only by staying away from church and by not reading his parish magazine. It has been reliably reported by various witnesses that some of the people that now and again tried to join his Bible study group or his literary class suffered from insomnia for many nights after they were so disturbed by the intensity of the thinking that was going on in those little groups. But though Mr. Peltz's view of the world in general and of Britain and the Anglican Church in particular was rather jaundiced and often very pessimistic, it must be admitted that he was always very sincere in his opinions. He really believed to his dying day that TV was a bad thing, especially for youngsters, although it has by now been proved statistically that juvenile delinquency has dropped by 2.5% since the introduction of three-dimensional technicolor stereophonic transmission and the discontinuance of censorship. Goes on, it talks about that the leukemia might... So he's imagining that there's been a third world war and the bomb's been dropped and nowhere near as many people as he thought had been killed by the nuclear explosion. Mm. And... his death has taken from Bolton one of the very few remaining old-fashioned and otherworldly characters whose ineffectiveness did not detract from his lovableness. And so he's having a big dig at his own, kind of seeing himself in a prophetic kind of way. And so I think that's quite...
It is. It's quite lovely.
Yeah.
So I just want to probably jump ahead to where the last little chapter in this rather amazing story is then... his move back to Australia and what was the catalyst for that?
Well, I mean, one of the patterns when you look at a life, I guess you've got to try and make sense of it. I mean, just talking a little earlier, one of the unpublished manuscripts that Werner wrote, which was kind of a magnum opus of his later life, was called The Curse of Abstraction. And so, of course, when you look at a life, you have to abstract and make patterns in a way. I guess you don't have to, but if you're trying to write a book about it. One of the patterns is how Werner did see himself as marginal. He was positioned as the margins in whatever he... So even in the internment camps, he wasn't one of the central players. He didn't go off and do his matriculation at which was offered and would have helped him later on. He was too dreamy. He was off, you know, walking the perimeter fence and looking at the stars and writing his poetry. So he was sort of on the periphery of that. And then he joined the church, sort of stumbled into that, and straight away, you know, rushed to the margins of the church. And it's someone who really didn't have much faith, and he finds himself in the church. And so it was really after he drifted out of the church. He'd had these years of writing where he wrote different books, another one called I Am Adolf Hitler that he co-wrote with Lottie, which was a kind of a more imaginative effort where they're ventriloquising Hitler in the bunker just in the last days. And then he did a PhD at Bristol University in sociology. And actually, I mean, this is something he wrote for the La Trobe Bulletin at the end, so we're jumping right to the end of his academic career, which was only 15 years, but I read it again, like the dialogue in Doubt with Doubt, because it reflects back on it. And he writes there, I came to sociology quintuply marginal. Getting on for 50, I'd wasted a lifetime not doing sociology. He's joking there. So is it because what he'd done is rushed to the margins of academia and sociology too? He was very critical of them. As an ex-parson, ex-theologian, I had lost one faith and was in search of another. How unacademic. So for Werner, it was always about the search or the making of meaning. And university was a place where that he felt that should be enabled. And so he railed against all the parts of the university that didn't enable that. My mind, shaped by German rather than Anglo-Saxon philosophy, was soft to the point of actually doubting facts. I still believe that literature, religion, the arts could directly contribute to sociological as well as any other understanding. So his PhD thesis was converted into a book and published by Routledge and was called The Scope of Understanding in Sociology. And it was in that he uses his... I mean, this was the remarkable thing. The man that I knew in his 60s and 70s and 80s was his erudition. So he'd read over so many disciplines, and he brought that interdisciplinary breadth to his teaching at La Trobe. Finally, I entered sociology at the top floor as a PhD candidate, doing research before I had been researched. All this made me terrifyingly insecure. What did I know? Did I know anything? And out there were hundreds of students waiting for me to tell them. At least I could sympathise with their anxieties. On the other hand, as latecomer, I had a rather pristine vision of my new discipline. High expectations were coupled with radical critique. Extraordinary luck had brought me to La Trobe. Our department is open, cosmopolitan, tolerant. I was left to find my feet in my own time, to develop my peculiar perspectives in my own way. From the start, I loved lecturing, the sharing of a continuing quest, but tutorials and seminars even more. This is one of the remarkable things about him. You know, most academics, they just don't... You know, they do the teaching part of it and the marking. They do that... Well, not all of them, obviously, but there's some reluctance in that. That's kind of not their real work. Their real work's the real... Well, Werner, and as he's saying, because he's an outsider within it, he wasn't really worrying so much about getting his work published. He was really interested in the teaching. For 13 years, I learned at least as much from the students, many of them mature, as I had ever learned from the grand masters of sociology, philosophy, etc., trying to communicate the latter's insights, theories, visions, hunches. I could make more sense of them. And sometimes my students would make me wonder whether the great ones had actually made much sense. Gradually, but inexorably, I was driven to question certain basic academic assumptions and practices ever more radically. And he goes on. And he ends it, in the meantime, let me add more gratefully that I have never enjoyed my work more than at La Trobe. And that certainly is... one of his students, you know, you couldn't imagine. It was like he'd found his vocation. Now, he may have presented that way in his earlier, you know, selves and careers. I don't know, but yeah. So he and Lottie had broken up, and that Lottie was a very damaged character. Perhaps not so much by the Holocaust, but what had preceded for her. She'd witnessed her mother had committed suicide and discovered her mother with her head in the oven, and she'd been sexually abused. And so she... And, you know, it was this thing that these two, when they met in 40, end of 42, 43, you know, they're these lost souls thrown together, as refugees must often experience. And they kind of... And there was incredible spark intellectually. And they had a sort of symbiosis happening in one sense, but Lottie was psychologically very traumatised, and people had been begging Werner to leave her for years, but he hadn't, and he didn't want to even at the end, but he did, and he became involved with a woman who became his second wife, which was Mary Zobel, and then he and her three children came out to Australia, which was a return for Werner, though he'd never really made much of that, the end of 1973, for him to take up this position at Latrobe.
Right.
And
he actually kept up quite strong correspondence with his son from his first marriage.
He did. Well, Peter remained in England, and Werner... That correspondence, I've had access to it, and again, like the photos, I'm quite confident will end up in the collection and will be a great addition to it, because Peter's kept all of Werner's letters through that, the 70s, 80s. There are some of it from the 90s in the collection already. Mm. And they had a wonderful kind of relationship, and I think... relation in correspondence anyway, and Werner's trying to convince Peter to come out. I mean, Peter had been quite damaged by his experience of growing up, as often happened with Holocaust survivors. Their parenting skills weren't so crash hot, and I mean, it is one of the ironies that Werner and Lottie thought they were saving the world, but you know, their own son was quite neglected in many ways, and so he's had to wrestle with that, and but his relationship with Werner ended up very well, and it is the letters that, and Peter, his son, thinks this too, that is some of Werner's best writing. Really, it's a great, because it has letters have the qualities that he had in friendship, and it was that where you in conversation where he would bring that incredible amount of experience and erudition, but also a capacity to listen and to engage with what his correspondent has been talking about. And, just expressed himself very well in that. I was going to read one of those letters. Which came at the... So Werner retired at the end of 1986... And he moved to, with Mary, they moved to Healesville, and he remained there until he died in 20 years later, in 2006. And, you know, Werner, I don't think, wanted to retire from Latrobe, but at that stage he had to when he was 65. But he took some of his, you know, never-ending curiosity and desire to learn through teaching into the community at Healesville, and was involved in U3A groups, numerous groups. I mean, in the last years of his life, he was still, you know, there's a film group, and there was this one group, the Tuesday group, which I think had begun as a U3A group, and it lasted for 19 years while he was, I think it's still going in his absence now. So he continued that work. Though I know that he often felt very frustrated that he hadn't found the right outlet to make the impact he felt he should. Now, this is a letter from 1995 to Gabby and Peter. And Peter Dane was a fellow that he met in the internment camps, and he went on to... So he went back to England, and Werner and Lottie had a lot to do with Gabby and Peter in those post-war years. And Peter had done the sensible thing and had matriculated while he was in the internment camps, and he went on and became a lecturer in English literature, and spent some time in Uganda, and he's lived an amazing life. There's just been a film made of his life. He's still alive. I interviewed him last year. He's an incredible character. He then in the 60s settled in New Zealand and was a lecturer at University of Auckland. And they kept in touch, and they were sort of lifelong friends, sparring partners a little bit. So this is the second paragraph of this letter. "Did I really, once upon a time, send you a joyful letter? I can't remember. You say it was last July, but if I did, I'm very glad, for I suddenly realised just how misleading I often must be in my pessimistic, prophetic, doom-oozing letters. Sure, the world is a pretty troubled place, and vast numbers of people are pushed into or kept in lifelong situations compared with which a life sentence in the first world spells sheer luxury. Not to mention the sufferings of people who outwardly seem to be well off. It is my trouble that throughout the greater part of my life, I've been made and kept too much aware of the many kinds of pain we inflict on each other in a crazy society which is interested in anything else except human concerns. But, one, these troubles trouble me so much because all the time I recognise the beauty of the earth, the marvellous potential of ordinary people, the numberless ways in which we could learn to help each other develop rather than stunt our capacities. Two, I myself feel I have remarkably little to complain of with any reasonableness. I have had undeservedly little pain in my life, and the nearest I have come to genuine suffering was always through those near to me who suffered so much more than I. Most of the time, I am very aware of this privilege. Personally, and not forgetting the diverse drawbacks that are a universal human condition, I have led a rich and joyful life. I have been granted a lively imagination, much time for thought and learning, good health, fitness, and felt so often so bad about this world of ours, precisely because so few in it seem to have been given the chances that were given to me. And why? So, please let this one joyful letter stand for the many others I should have written, not as an excuse, but as a kind of explanation. I may add that, for better, for worse, rightly or wrongly, I have always understood my life primarily as a task, not a gift. Or rather, being quite appreciative of the gift, I could never help judging my life in terms of the task that gradually grew to gigantic, unimaginable proportions, which, in turn, made me judge my life as an ever more total failure. What, in the light of my understanding of the global situation, have I actually done about it and for it? What it, anyway? Of course, all this is in some ways ridiculous, and some unconscious megalomania may receive its punishment in the process. But remember, once upon a time, almost till the days of our childhood, the world denoted a much more manageable part of that part or aspect of that which we now think of by this name. All religions enunciated an understanding of life in which the individual was a genuine part of, and therefore responsible for, her family, tribe, world. That understanding must still be an almost forgotten part of our soul's makeup, and it may be my luck, or bad luck, to be rather painfully conscious of that by now useless or unemployable part of conscience. Does this make sense to you? At this moment of outpouring, it does to me, but that too may be an illusion."
Mm. Mm.
And I think that's, you know, sums up many of the themes and some of the conundrums that I'm trying to deal with in writing about Werner's life.
Mm. I suppose my last question is then about you. What was the experience of the fellowship like to delve deeper into someone's life that you were so involved in?
Well, look, it was a wonderful... I'd never thought of writing about Werner's life while he was alive. If I had, I mean, he would have been pretty resistant to it, to be honest, I think. Though he would have been happy if I can do something creative with it. And, you know, he's not without ego. He would have been flattered as well on some level, I guess. But that thought to me came as I started to write an obituary after he died and then spoke at his funeral. And I thought, well, you know, there was a couple of generating things. One was that in his sentiment similar to this expressed here, that later towards a year or so before he died, he talked to me about how he felt. He didn't mind dying, but he felt that it would seem such a waste that the experiences and all the reading that he'd done would die with him. So he sort of was this trying to impersonalise that as something different from him. I thought, maybe by writing about his life I could give that another... you know, give that chord another strum or something. And the other was this sense of disappointment that he'd failed, you know. So that was both this tension of... He's one of the most humble people that I knew, and that may have been a function of his knowing him in his later life. But then this underlying hubris, you know, what was he expecting to achieve, you know, and that he was disappointed with what he'd done, because in... from most people's perspectives, he'd done quite a lot. And I used to say, oh, well, you know, you've influenced all these people teaching. And he had no truck with that. But to answer your question, the Creative Fellowship really enabled me to... So you have these ideas and then you might tell a few people that... So then you feel like, well, maybe I should definitely do it. But it's one thing to have the idea and then to be able to enact it. And the Fellowship gave me the impetus to enact it. And, yeah, I mean, it's been a great journey for me to trace through not only his life, but, I mean, about his ideas and how they developed, which is so central to his life, because he was, as we've talked about, you know, have these extreme experiences, but really a lot of it he was living in his head, which, again, it's another one of these paradoxes, which he would not shy away from, but it is that, you know, so he's against paradox, he's against abstraction, and yet... he's living in his head rather than sort of, you know, reflecting on what's actually happening to him in any specific way. So yeah, it's been a great privilege to be able to immerse myself in that.
Well, and I must say, it's been a great privilege to hear more about Werner's life, and it's lovely to have you come along this evening and share with us his stories and his letters. So would you please thank Roger Averill, everybody.